Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I'd like to present the results of some six-year experiments looking at within-field variability in soil phosphorus buffer capacity. And by soil phosphorus buffer capacity, I'm talking about the net phosphorus addition or removal per unit change in soil test phosphorus, fertilizer addition minus crop removal. Why study variation in buffer capacity? I think from a fertilizer management perspective, there are two pretty sound reasons. First, when we're making fertilizer phosphorus rate decisions on our farm in Minnesota, we take a soil sample, look at a phosphorus rate chart, compare our soil test level to an established critical value, take into account an estimate of crop removal, a broad assumption about phosphorus buffer capacity, and apply a rate. Then come back in 4 or 6 years and retest and see how we did. Well, the problem with this approach, potentially, is that the available economic evidence suggests that there are large returns to be had by attaining the critical soil test phosphorus level right now, not at some point in the distant future. And if there are wide differences in buffer capacity within fields, then we're probably getting our rates wrong and not getting the critical soil test level correct right now. So, both from a resource use perspective, economics, and environmental risk of overapplication, we could potentially be doing better by considering variability in phosphorus buffer capacity. And secondly, if we're ever going to get to a point of moving from a critical soil test phosphorus level based on purely a yield response curve to a critical soil test level that is economic, we need to know not just the response curve, but also how much phosphorus it takes to get there. And that's knowing the buffer capacity. So to start down the road in answering these questions, we have two research objectives. First of all, to look and see, is there field scale variability in buffer capacity? Second, to what other soil properties might these differences be related? Research plots were established in the fall of 2001 at two sites in south central Minnesota. Both had similar topography. Both were 16-hectare fields. Canisteo, Clarion, Webster, Nicollet soils formed from calcareous glacial till and topography typical of the prairie pothole region of southern Minnesota. Initial soil test values from the fall of 2001. First, I'll highlight pH. As Dan Kaiser mentioned a couple talks ago, ranges of soil pH typical of this region. Low side about 5.5, high side about 8.0. Also wide variability in soil test phosphorus. Because of the pH range and the amount of high pH soil in these sites, we did all our work with the Olson soil test. Even on the Olson soil test, ranges from 5 to 60 at one site, 4 to 34 at the other. Here's our experimental design. Blocked field into strips receiving phosphorus at 56 kilograms a hectare prior to the corn year on the rotation. These fields were in a corn-soybean rotation, corn in even-numbered years. And we had 132 cells at one site, 138 at the other with one more at the end. These are 9 meters by 15 meters. Soil samples were taken each fall in the center and in a 3-meter radius around. And also in each fall, harvest measurements, grain yield, and grain samples were taken. So at each of those cells, at each field, we plotted the change in Olsen soil test phosphorus over time. This is an example of what we did at one cell. We calculated the slope, and to determine the calculated soil P buffer capacity, we took the net phosphorus addition, newer phosphorus rates, subtracted the crop removal, divided by 6 for an average annual change, divided that by the slope of that soil test phosphorus change over time. Results. At both sites, in both treatments, we observed very distinct evidence of spatial correlation in the soil buffer capacity. The ranges were consistent across treatments within sites. These are semivariograms showing the semivariance in the y-axis, range in meters on the x-axis. And I'd like to highlight some of the sources of variability that we observed. First of all, if we look at the mean buffer capacity across treatments, we were looking at between 8 and 11 kilograms of phosphorus per unit change in the Olsen soil test, which is similar to other values that one sees reported in the literature. If we look comparing treatments at both sites, the buffer capacity going up, increasing soil test phosphorus, was significantly lower than it was going down, reducing soil test phosphorus. And this behavior has also been observed in some data reported from Iowa in long-term studies by Jacob Prater, where again you see the slope of soil test phosphorus going up with cumulative P addition is much steeper than the slope going down. See it also in data again from Iowa from Regis Voss, slope going up, steeper than the slope going down. Maybe evidence of a hysteresis, perhaps related to precipitation of calcium phosphates in these calcareous soils. Looking at differences within the treatment that was receiving fertilizer phosphorus, largest source of variation was pH dependent, probably related to calcium carbonate equivalent of the soil. pH above 7.4, buffer capacity was between 1.5 and 3.5 times higher than it was pH lower than 7.4. And we can see this pretty clearly plotting the data, pH on the x-axis, buffer capacity on the y-axis. pH gets over 7.4, we start to observe some pretty high buffer capacity values. At all of our soil test locations, we also ran a phosphate borate mineralizable nitrogen test, PBMN, as a index of potentially mineralizable nitrogen in the soil. After accounting for pH, we still observed a significant difference at one site depending on the mineralization value. As you see, mineralizable nitrogen starts running above 300 to 350 kilograms per hectare. Buffer capacity tends to go down. Perhaps the mineralization index is also picking up some potentially mineralizable phosphorus. We don't know. There is some reason to suggest that at the site where the difference was significant, the mineralization test would have been doing a potentially better job of predicting actual mineralization. The Anthony site was well-drained tiled soils. Wurzburger site was very poorly drained, and mineralization may well have been inhibited by soil moisture in many years. Finally, looking at the buffer capacity under soil test drawdown, The primary source of variation was the initial Olson soil test phosphorus level. At low values, buffer capacity appeared to be significantly higher. And this makes intuitive sense, I think. When your initial soil test phosphorus gets on this low end, it takes an awful lot of removal to make it go even lower. So, conclusions. Phosphorus buffer capacity demonstrates pretty clear spatial variability within the fields and has a definite spatial structure. With phosphorus addition, this variation is related to soil pH and potentially to soil mineralization. With net phosphorus removal, variation was related to the initial soil test phosphorus levels. And the magnitude of the observed variation was large enough to substantially affect the fertilizer P application rates needed to attain critical soil test phosphorus levels. So, particularly in an era when a lot of our phosphorus is being applied with variable rate technology, I think we could do well to take more account of variation in soil phosphorus buffer capacity when making our rate decisions. Thanks to the Minnesota corn growers and Minnesota soybean growers for supporting this research, and thanks to you. I'll take any questions. Unfortunately, we did not look at anything else to take into consider phosphorus buffering capacity. This was something of a retrospective study. It was initially a nitrogen phosphorus yield response trial, and we were going back and mining the data to see what else we could learn. We should have looked at cation or calcium carbonate equivalent and still have the soil samples, so I think we still can. It could well be very uneconomical. Yep.
So what's your thoughts on how you use that information in the future?
Well, if we know the buffer capacity, we can get to the point where we can calculate an economic optimum soil test level. And
it would be a different soil test target for the calcareous
soil. It could well be. And also, I think that perhaps we can get to the point of determining if the crop response portion of the curve looks different in those soils as well. Some initial evidence from the yield portion of this work suggests that critical levels in the high pH areas may be considerably higher than in the neutral or acid soils in the sites.
We've had a really good session. We have a chance now for discussion. And I know I went back and looked at a few of the different kind of categories in our sessions here and broke them out into a few different areas. Let me see how many of our authors we have left here. The one that we just kind of finished up was the soil test phosphorus, soil test potassium area. I know Peter Scharf, we just had we weren't able to get any questions from him. So I'll open that area up if we have people that want to discuss setting critical levels or particular for Peter on his research in looking at critical levels for soil test phosphorus or phosphorus and potassium response. Carl.
Got a question. We need to reevaluate our recommended soil sampling depths. Well, that's a good question. There's a lot of parts to the answer. The first one is, if you can make a better prediction, can you get anyone to do it? So just because you can make a better prediction with a deeper sample doesn't mean you can really do that. I know Minnesota, for example, what they do, they have a subsoil map. We've had, and somehow the adjustment, there's an adjustment to the recommendation from a given soil test value in the top 6 inches based on what region of the state you're in. So that's one approach. Wisconsin uses some other approach that I can't call to mind right now. But, you know, I think that realistically, whatever your root zone is, that's where you're potentially getting P and K from. Your response to P and K is going to depend on the whole supply. It's a bit more of a practicality thing that we do 6 inches or whatever. So that frames the question. I don't know the answer. The frame is you could probably do a better job, but you're going to do a lot more work to do it. And when you look at the surveys of how many people, you know, do their soil samples every 4 years with a 6-inch sample, that means the inputs can go through if they didn't make a 24-inch or 36-inch sample. And I'm not sure you'd be moving the whole area forward by doing that. But what can you do? And that's kind of why I came to the thing with using the yield monitor data. It's very simple, and it integrates all that.
Okay, thanks.
Peter, can you answer Dan's question with your database? He asked whether you should fertilize the low or the high. Apparently, you have lower fermenting areas. So, do you have more response in the low fermenting areas or high?
That is a good question. It's an excellent question, and I don't think that I tried looking at that. It was kind of dumb.
Well, you look at yield change, you know.
Right, and so I could
probably go from 100 to 110 or 200.
I could probably go back to my hotel room and get my computer and do that and tell you, but I can't tell you right now. I can tell you that in that first field, the one with the loamy sand, you'd think that that might be low yielding, lower than the other soils that are able to deliver more water, but it was an irrigated field and the yields were excellent in that area. I don't know if anyone noticed this, but in that aerial photo of that field, you could actually kind of see the zero PK strip through on the south end where we got the big response, and that wasn't a picture that we took, but it was just a 2010 National Agricultural Imagery Program photo that happens to be on our GIS server for Missouri, and they had taken an aerial photo of that during the growing season, and you can see where it was in P and K, where there was a big response, it was visible from the air, that it just was growing thinner, but I would tend to say that that's probably not that big of a controlling factor what the yield level was. In fact, now that I think about it, the third one that I showed you, the one in southwest Missouri with the injected P and K, yield was not a significant predictor of response, yield level. And the other two we have not tested yet.
Yeah.
Does the subsoil P and K come from natural sources or previous fertilizer application?
Good question. Does subsoil P and K come from fertilizer or natural? I would say probably some of both. I think that a lot of our soils have pretty substantial play at some point in the profile, and any excess P and K is not going to go past that. So I think there's a good chance that we're going to get accumulation of past applications there. My suspicion is that a substantial part of it is native, but that probably past applications play a role also.
And because of the farm with the father and son, without fertilizer applications, points to the fact that it was a lot natural.
Right. And then, you know, I don't know the history of how long the father had been farming it
prior
in that particular
to
field.
Yeah.
But that could be looked into. And so we could start to answer that question by doing the right kinds of investigations and, you know, find out what the management history is and, you know, see if that predicts how much subsoil P and K there is. I would suspect that it would. Even if it's mostly native, past management is probably going to affect what's there now.
Yeah. I just was maybe more of a comment, but I'm just thinking of drawing down these phosphorus levels in the soils, a little bit like our federal government. You know, future generations are the ones that are going to have to pay for that, in that phosphorus prices may very well be higher in the future than they are now, and if you draw those down, the long-term effect on these soils may be actually increased cost over the next generation.
Well, you're exactly right.
for 10 years, someone could have done what I've outlined here. You know, we have a lot of people that had yield monitored 10 years ago that could have done this. But if they had done it, they'd be looking back and kicking themselves now because they would have saved a lot on cheap P&K, and now be having to do full replacement of a much more expensive P&K. It could go that way into the future easily, that, you know, that 20 years from now, the person that does what I'm suggesting kicks themselves because they have not saved that capital in those reserves, which will be much more expensive to replace or to apply, supply in the future. So if you had a crystal ball and you knew what the price of P&K would be, that would help you make your decision. But you identify the key thing that people should have in mind before they decide to proceed down that path, that they're kind of handcuffing themselves on future applications. They're not going to have that soil bank to withdraw from anymore nearly as much as they can, if they could, if they don't do this.
One of the other challenges is when you go to buy a piece of land, I ended up intentionally in Missouri for a period of time, and there was a farmer there that just draw down all these levels. Somebody's previous owner draw down all the levels, and when he asked me, you know, actually bought this piece of land from a different country, came here and settled, and then looked at the soil testing, everything, it needed everything, lime, phosphorus, potassium, and it's going to be more important as people buy land as they look at these levels.
Absolutely, you wouldn't catch me buying land without looking at them, because it's a tremendous part of the capital that's in the land.
Okay, thanks. I had alluded to the fact that we're talking about increasing efficiency of phosphorus fertilizers, and we don't have a lot of time left, but I had mentioned that, so I want to talk about it. I know Brian came back. We had four authors that addressed this, and let me just see who's here. Maud Ali, I don't see him back. Clayne Jones had a presentation on increasing fertilizer use efficiency with additives, and Clayne's not here. I think you might be on the spot, Brian. And then Barney Gordon had a presentation, and he's not here. So as far as specific authors, we have Brian here, but I'm open to discussing those sets of four presentations as a group for those of us who are interested in doing so. Anyway, are there questions from the audience on that? Were you raising your hand, or?
Yeah, I was, but I really am curious about why Dr. Gordon gets such different results than many of us using a bale, because we have 30 years of site data from very low to very high soil test. We just don't see any benefit, and we have a pH range of about 5.5 to 6.5. So I was just curious as to why our data, along with some of my colleagues in the rest of the South and Mid-Atlantic, is showing very different results than
his data. That's a very good question, and I'm sure there are some other people that are going to have some comments. Yeah.
That plays into my question. I was wondering at what level of calcium in the soil does a bale stop being doing its job well? I'm in Arizona. We've got 6,000, 8,000 part per million calcium. Can what rate of a bale is going to tie up those cations to keep our phosphorus more available?
Well, is that actually even the mechanism?
Yeah. Yes. Brian.
So even though that wasn't what I talked about, but I've done work, and matter of fact, I've got a publication just coming through, should be in the next few months, in terms of my nutrition on arborum, the bale and potato. And we had interesting results. We had some no response, some response. We even had one huge negative response. And at first, I wasn't really inclined to publish it, but the more I got looking at it, I was like, I don't want to do that. So I spent a lot of time searching literature and talking to folks, and I'll just summarize what I found in all of that, and maybe I don't have everything represented, but it seemed to me that in the case, and this is obvious, in a lot of the cases that I was looking at from other folks, no responses or negative responses were coming from high soil test P or even medium, or high rates of P. And so, and I've seen that with the bale, I've seen it with folic acid, humic acid. You get enough P on there, and you don't see a response. And sometimes we see a negative response. And so, for us anyway, we found that where we did get a response with Adele, it was both low soil test P and low rates. I mean, we're having to cut that rate. You know, and that seems to pretty much fit the data mostly. I found some exceptions to that. Dave Mendel did some work on corn and, mm-hmm. in Kansas, and Dave Franson did some in beets. They had really low soil test P and really low rates, and they didn't get a response. But you know, there are some out there. Anyway, so if anybody wants, I'd be happy to send that paper to you, sort of a literature review. I think it's a fair evaluation of it. And I also reviewed the chemistry, at least what's published from, there's been a little bit of chemistry work done in my lab, Rich Conan's lab, and Hernandez, or I can't remember his name now, but you know, looking at a little bit, I mean, there's a lot we don't know about it, but I definitely think, based on things I've seen in my lab, work that we've done with the bill, it's definitely impacting the chemistry of calcium and aluminum and et cetera. So what it's doing, I don't know. There's still lots of questions there. Anybody would be happy to share that information with anybody that would like.
Okay. Peter?
Yeah, I haven't done any research with it, but what I tell people is this. Our current system basically says, hit this target level for P, and then you're good. And all our data says that that target level is above the point at which we're likely to get a response. I mean, essentially, our data is, if you're at that target level, you're never going to get a response to P. And I tell them, if you're doing our basic system, our basic meat and potatoes P and K system, you can skip a year of P and K if the prices are bad or the weather doesn't get it done, and you're not going to lose a bushel. And then you come back and you double up the next year and you're back where you started, so you've got this cushion on top. So all you're doing when you fertilize is replenishing the soil's ability to do that. Well, if this year's fertilizer is just replenishing the soil P, then and the soil can provide everything your crop needs, then I don't see how a bale can actually help you out in that situation. And that's what ties into what Brian's saying. If it's a low soil test P, then maybe you've got a chance. If you've got somebody who wants to manage that low soil test P, maybe they should think about it. And I know you have some low soil test.
But that was our concern. We didn't, you know, at low soil test P, and even low rates of phosphorus application, because we did a P rate trial, we weren't seeing a bale.
Right. You said Dave Mangle and Dave both got that same result also, but I'm not talking on the basis of experimental results, and I'm not talking about what happens when you've got those soil tests. I'm just saying if you don't, you really can't expect anything.
Right. But we didn't see it when we had those results.
Right.
So that was my question.
Hey, Brian, I guess I have a question for you, maybe just a little bit more clarification on that other product that you did present on. There, you did see a response. Do you have any ideas on the chemistry and the mechanism behind why that response is there?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot we don't know. So we, you know, a few years ago, I sort of published some of Jeff Stark's data on humic acid, and a different product on potato. My name has been abused nationwide by folks who like to sell that product, or any product that's even similar. So, and I really take exception to that. And I, you know, basically said, hey, you know, this is on potato, which is a really high P needy crop on very calcareous, low organic matter soils. And that was about the limit of what we were willing to say. Is that, you know, it looks like you can cut your P rate if you add humic acid in, but it won't. Again, one of the problems is that we see variable results because I think we get variable products out there. As far as the chemistry goes, the only time I'm really seeing it really beneficial is in these calcareous soils that have low organic matter. Not to say that it couldn't happen elsewhere, but that's where I've measured it, is in those conditions. And so I believe, based on that, plus some other chemistry work that's been done, is that there's some type of, I don't know, if it's hydrogen or water bonding or something that's making that P just a little more soluble. But if you're doing what Peter's talking about, and you've already got a buffer of P in the soil, it's probably not going to help because I don't think it's long term. It's probably a short-lived type of reaction. And the other thing is that we've done a bunch of work on broadhead stuff. We just don't get responses. What we're seeing is when we put it in a liquid band and we cut the rate, we seem to be able to get by with less phosphorus when we mix it with a humic or a fulvic acid. So I think that's what's going on. I think it's just chemistry-wise, I don't know exact chemistry, but some kind of living exchange or something that's making the phosphorus more soluble. And the plant's able to get it. And we've got multiple data sets showing that in potato, not in a lot of other crops, but we're starting to collect it in other crops as well. But again, I would limit that to my conditions. Low organic matter soils, low P.
Okay.
Tom? I just had another comment. I'm hoping anybody else can shed some light on this. We're seeing a lot of microbially based products now. Bug in a jug, that's what my farmers tend to call them. And plants are notoriously poor miners of phosphorus in the soil. And microbes are better miners. Are we going to be able to access that phosphorus bank that's been building up, particularly out west, where we've been adding 600-800 pounds per acre of phosphorus for 25 years or more? That phosphorus is still there. It's not gone anywhere. Can we access that portion of the bank that the Olson test and the Gray test don't show us is there, but clearly is there? Does anybody have any experience with any of these microbial products? And do they work?
Yes and no.
I'm currently working with a couple of farmers right now to try to validate this over the next couple of years.
Yeah, but I try to look at every product that comes along. And, you know, if they want to look at it, I'll look at it. But I have never seen anything. Now, the problem is a lot of times they're blended with humic or fulvic acid, so then you're trying to separate it. Even this carbon P that we did work on, you know, they company was kind of making claims of this and that. And we actually took all the components and isolated them and looked in, you know, and came down to, no, the only thing that's happening is enhanced phosphorus solubility. And we even did hydroponic work on it and the Bell, by the way, both of them, and showed, you know, there's no growth regulator, there's nothing like that happening with them. Whatever's happening is happening soil chemistry with phosphorus in both of those products. So, but again, I say humic acid, fulvic acid, what are you getting? I think that's the biggest problem. Yeah, you don't know what you're buying. That's the problem I see is inconsistency. So I just tell the owner, you better buyer beware. You better make sure whoever you're working with's got the same product every time and they've got some data backing it up.
I think these organic ligands talk about chemistry, they're probably competing with the phosphorus on the absorption sites on the calcite salt phase. But I was wondering, I think you could quantify that by doing absorption isothermal phosphorus with and without these products. You know, you're alluding to the fact that it's greater solubility, but you know, absorption isothermal phosphorus with and without these products.
Yeah,
that would
be good. I am alluding to solubility just based strictly on enhanced uptake and also leaching column, just strictly looking at phosphorus coming out of the bottom. And so I don't know what's going on. I'll admit that right
now. Okay. We're about 15 minutes past the end of our session. I greatly appreciate everybody sticking around and discussing this. And if you have more questions, I guess you can stay in here or go out in the hallway and discuss them. Thanks.